So it looks like we have quorum. Whichever co-chair will be facilitating this meeting, I think you can feel free to go.
It's today you, Derek?
Sorry, I think it is. Sorry about this. And I am just pulling up the meeting notes. I just came back from an outing with my guys. Sorry about that.
I'll take care of it this week.
No, that's okay. I actually have it up. I just need to first bring up the, I think we're looking at, well, we're doing the welcome. Hello, everyone. I'm Derek Mapp. I'm the, sorry about that, Richard. I'm the co-chair of the community and engagement subcommittee. Richard, would you like to start and just pop it to the next person?
Hi, everyone. Richard Sullivan, council co-chair. Stephen.
Hey, folks. Stephen Spano, the HCAP staff attorney at the AIDS Legal Referral Panel. And I'll pop it to Maria.
Hello, Maria Lacayo, and I'm with DPH HIV Health Services. And today's my first meeting, so thank you for having me. Hi, Derek.
I'll jump in. Mark Bowler, council staff. Mark Bowler, council staff. Lee.
Thank you so much, Lee Jewell, council member. Kara.
Kara, council staff. And I'll pop it over to Craig.
Hey, everybody. Crown Council staff. That's everybody.
Hey. And is that everyone? I guess that is. Next, I think we're pulling up February meetings notes.
Agenda first, and then.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you about that. Could you pull up the agenda for today? And I guess we're voting by consent. If there's anyone who, I don't see anyone who's looking for any changes in the agenda. So let's move on to the minutes from last meeting. If there's any changes that anyone would like to see from the last meeting. All right, not seeing any or hearing any dissent, let's accept those meeting minutes. And we're off on a roll. Are there any announcements from the committee members? Okay. Mark.
Just a reminder that this month's meeting on the 27th is going to be our return to in-person full council meetings. And so the time is for 4 to 6:30, and hope to see you all there. There'll be a meal, whether that meal is a box to go or a hot meal that you can eat there is TBD, but you'll be seeing some kind of food.
Exciting. Sorry about that. Let me ask you this, if you could, Mark, just as a reminder, the in-person meeting is just for the full council meeting, but not for the subcommittee meeting. Is that correct still?
Yeah, the guidance seems pretty specific about it being the commission, the meetings of the commissions themselves. And so the full council is the actual commission. That means that committees can continue, if they want, to meet remotely. I do know that two out of the three committees definitely want to continue. Well, I've only heard secondhand that this is one of those two committees. So I've heard that one committee would like to continue meeting virtually, this one. I know that another committee, Council Affairs, that definitely wants to continue meeting virtually. And then the third membership, they're kind of like, we'll see. And so we will see. The steering committee can also continue to meet remotely unless there is a substantive vote that has to go from steering to the full council. And so like if there's a vote on carry forward allocation, resource allocation, some big plan that we've been a part of developing, then the steering committee will need to meet in person to review that and then send a motion to the full council. Does that make sense to everyone? So for example, this month's meeting of the steering committee, there's nothing substantive on there. And by substantive, that's not to, to diminish the other items. Substantive is basically only around like money and like big plans, you know. By plans, I mean like integrated plans, you know, stuff like that, that we actually are not receiving, but that we've actually helped develop, of which we actually don't have anything on the dock right now. We've mainly been in advisory roles in the past few years. That might change. Does that make sense?
Yes. So this meeting, this subcommittee will be meeting virtually for the time being.
I'm just going to assume that in the future. Yeah, I'm just going to assume that all of the subcommittees will continue meeting virtually until council staff is told otherwise.
Okay, great. Any other questions in regards to that? I am going to just say that there are no public comments because I don't see anyone from the public here. So we can move on to the council member, is this correct? Attendance report?
Oh, no, I think you're looking at membership. The next one is HCAP.
Oh, HCAP, sorry about that. Yes, HCAP with Stephen Sapano.
Thank you all. So I am very excited about the in-person stuff. I don't think that I've given an in-person annual report, but I'll be doing my annual report this year. If I remember correctly, Mark might be able to remind me, but I think the first one I did was virtual. So I'm excited to do it in person. I'll start by just following up on a case that we discussed last month. By way of reminder, this was a case where the client was referred to HCAP. She is quadriplegic, and she was terminated from her Homebridge services. There's little recourse for any kind of hearing or due process, even though it is an entitlement, because she is technically still eligible for her hours through IHSS. I did advocate with Homebridge. I did everything that I could. I spoke with colleagues who have had similar issues, and I was unsuccessful in overturning the termination, unfortunately. What I did do was get a commitment from them to reassess in 6 months to see whether the client was eligible again for their services. That may or may not result in a reconnection to their services. I am still concerned about the client, but what I did do was advise the client on some of the things that she can do for herself in the next 6 months, including engaging in mental health services, trying to get some anger management training and some support for kind of, psychosocial support so that she can, you know, show some headway, and some wraparound services to try and get her reconnected. And at that point, I told her that I'll be happy to reengage, and I told her that she can contact me at any point. But unfortunately, this was a decision where the contractor just was unwilling to overturn their decision. So I'll remain in contact with the client. I will support as necessary, as I always will. So I wanted to update the committee on that. I wanted to also note on page 3, 2022-91.
Well, Stephen, if I can stop you there, it looks like there's a couple of hands, including mine, for this particular case.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. Yeah. Go for it. Richard?
Yeah, hi, Stephen. That's kind of disturbing. I just wanted to know the reasons behind a quadriplegic being denied services. What, like money ran out or the time? I mean, that seems pretty harsh.
So I it's a complicated issue. On the agency side, the agency decision came as a result of two things. First of all, that what they stated was that the client had some behaviors that were unmanageable. I am not a provider who thinks that, you know, there is no limit to, you know, what a provider of last resort must do to support folks. But in this instance, there was no violence. There was no, you know, there was no threat. You know, it wasn't there was some behaviors that, you know, would be expected to stem from trauma. The client had, from what I can see and from speaking with the providers, my impression was that the client actually did make a lot of headway with regard to their mental health, and they were trying to engage. One interesting thing did come up, and you know, when I tried to advocate and say, you know, this client did try to engage in mental health services and was having trouble due to the pandemic, the provider responded saying, well, Stephen, that doesn't make sense. Why hasn't this happened sooner? Therapy became readily available to everybody virtually over pandemic. It was more widely available than anything else. And while they're right, it did provide access for a lot of folks who didn't have it previously. This is a unique situation. When I spoke with the client on the phone, because of their quadriplegia, they have certain voice commands on their phone, like hang up, you know, to say things on the phone. And like in three different instances, she accidentally hung up on me because she was telling me a story about how she told somebody that she was going to hang up. or that she was hung up on. And so I could imagine doing some of the really hard work in therapy, having like voice commands like that and the phone set up being, you know, she said that email is actually very difficult for her to deal with. While it might make things so much more accessible for a lot of other people, the nature of her disabilities actually makes it far less a workable world for her, you know? And so while everybody else was adapting to virtual life very easily, for her, in-person mental health support was a really critical component, and she wasn't able to access that during pandemic. And so I did voice that. It did not overturn the decision. It didn't carry the weight that I would have hoped it would. But you know, to answer your question more directly, what it came down to was, you know, and Homebridge told me, you know, listen, we're not trying, this isn't a situation where we're trying to get rid of a client who has some bad behaviors. At this point, we have no providers that, you know, the client has a list of people that they don't want to come to their house. And the service provider had a list of people who would not work with the client. And it became an unworkable solution, according to the provider, to manage the staffing. And, you know, in my efforts, I did try to explore what other options, as we talked about last month, I tried to explore what options are available for clients with, you know, this level of need or this kind of need for home health support. And they simply don't exist in the HIV services world. And so right now, the client is without that level of care. I think she's currently being cared for by her mother and her cousin, who are local, but that's not a very sustainable situation. So does that answer your question, Richard, about a little bit more background?
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Stephen, for the reply. I mean, I know you do your best, and I mean, technically, yeah, service provider. I don't know all the details, but you explained some of them. But just in my heart of hearts, I hate to sound pitying, but a quadriplegic that's just denied like that, that sucks. So I know there's rules, but just on the surface, that's extremely sad.
I agree, and I made that plea, it unfortunately didn't change the decision. It is just unfortunate that, I'll tell you what's most unfortunate is, you know, in the HIV services world, right, what I could do with HCAP is if the client had, let's say, a case manager that they weren't getting along with and the relationship had just deteriorated to a beyond repair, I could try to refer them to a different case manager, right? Okay, well, maybe there's a different clinic that we can send you to. Let's link you up with a different care team. Let's start anew, right? In this instance, there is one provider in the city that is contracted by IHSS to provide this level of support, and it's Homebridge. So there is no alternative service provider to turn to. And that is the most unfortunate thing. We really do need to dedicate some resources in our society to supporting our community's most vulnerable members. And we just simply do not do that. But I agree with you. Mark?
I think you answered, I think, a lot of what I was going to ask about, which is basically around alternatives and referrals. So this is the one specific agency contracted to provide services to folks with HIV, but because of their rationale, and I actually get the rationale, whether I agree or not, I get it. If there's a list of providers that the client doesn't want to see, and there's a list, of providers who have felt like, I don't know, unsafe, whatever, not to be diminishing, that could be just like, okay, well, this equals there's zero support. Okay. But, you know, the subset that they are doing is a subset of in-home support services, of which, like, why then, if they aren't able to do it, wouldn't this client be able to get basic IHSS work from IHSS rather than the actual subcontractor?
Yeah, you know, so just a point of clarification, this is Homebridge is not an HIV service provider. They're not an HCAP provider. That's why I'm kind of talking more vocally about it. They are publicly known as the only provider of in-home support for IHSS services. So that's the only reason I'm talking about it on the record. I would not normally mention providers by name. And
of course,
and you know that. That being said, so look, you know, most of us are providers. We work for providers' offices, or we've worked very closely with providers' offices, and everybody is tapped with resources. That is true. And sometimes it can be a challenge to deal with staffing if a client won't work with a particular person or won't speak with a particular person or has a volatile relationship with another person. It can be difficult to manage that. And I get that. But yes, you're right. There is no, there is no alternative in this instance. I will note that something did come up that really did kind of bug me with it, which is the client reported. She said, "Stephen, I have been working on my behavior. They're just not giving me any credit for it." And what she reported was she would have new providers that she had not met before, that she had not put on a do not call list, that she had no reason to do that with, that would come in and they would say things like, "Oh, wow, I don't know why. I don't know why they warned me about you. You're really sweet." And she, you know, and so like there was kind of this like, this is the client's report, right? But the client reported that because it was like almost as though she was labeled as this person before even being given a chance to kind of remediate things, and really wasn't feeling like she was giving a fair shake at kind of like overcoming the evils of the past, whatever they may have been, you know? And that is unfortunate if that's happening. Her attempt to complain about that is what the client feels ultimately led to this disruption in services. And so it winds up being like, you know, in law school, I had an evidence teacher use the term chicken killer. Like once a chicken killer, always a chicken killer. Like you can't overcome the evidentiary burden of once you bring in all these character, you know, the character assaults of a criminal, they don't really get a chance at a fair trial. And that's why we limit the amount of character evidence we can give to a defendant, you know? It is unfortunate if that's happening in the outside the purview of the court, where people really can't access their services as a result.
But I guess going back to my question, so there are no other alternative agencies like within the IHSS network that could provide sort of stopgap care, even if it's not HIV funded, if it's funded through other means? I mean, you know, Ryan White funded, if it's funded through other means?
So not that I've been able to find. So I think that her medical case management team was looking into other home health options, but you know, the client being low income, everything goes through Medi-Cal, and Homebridge is direct linked through Medi-Cal, and it's the only way to get those services. The other option, and this is why I am precluded from really bringing any kind of, requesting any kind of hearing on this, is IHSS position is, oh, she has all the hours she wants. She just needs to find a provider. But she doesn't have somebody to, for those of you who aren't available or who aren't aware of this, IHSS provides services in two different ways. They are the kind of entity under the Department of Health Services that dedicates the hours. They come out, they do an assessment, they say, okay, this client needs 400 hours of a month of care. And then there's two mechanisms to get that. You can hire a friend or a partner or a daughter or a cousin or somebody, and IHSS will pay them to do the care, or they will link you with Homebridge, who finds those providers for you if you meet the criteria for that program. And she did. So from IHSS perspective, she's eligible for the services. There's been no denial of services on a government level. And so I'm precluded from any kind of governmental recourse. It's the contractor that is basically denying the services. There is unfortunately no way, apart from her going on Craigslist and trying to hire somebody that will do this work for this, you know, very small amount of money. And at times the client needs two people, right? Because she needs to get moved. Like, she can't move herself. And she needs to be moved regularly because she will get, abrasions and bed sores, and that has led to hospitalizations before. So she requires a very high level of need, and it's not easy to find people. And I should note, the people that cook food or do grocery shopping make the same amount as the people that do this kind of paramedical level of care for a client. So it's very difficult to find providers who will do the more difficult work that needs to get done and take on more liability and more strenuous work with a client, when they could just as easily get paid going shopping and doing a little bit of laundry for folks for the same amount of, you know, for the same salary. So there are some challenges within that system that make it more difficult. I have tapped my knowledge of resources, Mark, to see what is available, and I have run into nothing but barriers.
Yeah, so, it sounds like it. I appreciate all the work that you put into this. I know that it must have been very emotionally trying and draining as well, right? Coming up against it all.
It's upsetting, but I am trying to remain hopeful, and I'm trying to help the client remain hopeful that in 6 months we can make some headway and make a strong advocacy effort for her to get reengaged. I'm just hoping she hangs in there that long and you know, isn't institutionalized before that.
So I take it there's no home like nursing, something equivalent to like Hospice by the Bay, that's coming in to help with like turning her over and things like that?
No. And that's the other thing. The client is extremely young. She's in her 20s. So she's not eligible for a lot of the services that she might be eligible for. She's not eligible. Yeah. So this is a really sad case.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, Stephen. Just really fast, and it's in regards to the same case that you've been talking about, and I guess we can move on if that's good for you for some of the other cases. But I do you think it is worthwhile to see if there is a way of crafting a advert on her behalf and perhaps using her family members that are helping her out at this point to vet potential folks who potentially could be an appropriate match for her.
That's an interesting solution that I hadn't thought about. I hadn't thought about crafting a job posting for her. But it does seem like there's something to that. I think Mark just hit that on the head too. That's what I was thinking. It might be something for me to loop in case management about her medical case manager. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'll do whatever anybody needs to get them support. I do think that medical case manager would be more better situated to be clear about what the needs are, because I'm not entirely, I mean, I know the client's level of disability on a general level enough to advocate, but I don't know the ins and outs of what her daily life needs are and what her ADL, exactly what the ADL support looks like.
Gotcha. Right.
But that's a great idea. And I'm going to follow up on your and Mark's recommendation that I reach out to case management about that. Yeah. I will say, there's only a couple of cases here that I did want to highlight. That was the one that I wanted to follow up on because I know there was concern about it. I am still concerned about it. I did have a case. This is a case coming out of Laguna Honda. I'm not supposed to say that. So I apologize. Erase that from the record. Strike that is what the lawyers say. I apologize. So there is a SNF here in the Bay Area. We know that the skilled nursing facilities, a lot of folks who are moving from the skilled nursing facilities to independent living require a very high level of support because they're being supported. I wanted to kind of mention this because it does touch on a little bit of what we're talking about with the other case, where is a client who requires a high level of need with regard to case management in this instance, as opposed to home health support. When they're moving to some other facility where that facility has some case management, bringing in outside organizations is a challenge because it winds up being a duplication of services. But I did think it was interesting to bring this up because there is one organization here in the city. It is not Ryan White Care funded. It was developed specifically for the needs of folks exiting from a skilled nursing facility to move to independent living to fill that need gap. And it is a very effective model. I have yet to be able to connect anyone to their services. And in this instance, the client was connected, but because they're moving to an RCFCI where there's on-site case manager, they are now terminating as a result of duplication of services. This is as of today, I heard this, so it's not on the report, but I'm reporting it now. I was able to advocate to keep the client connected to the extent that if the client moves to more independent living within a year, we can kind of readdress and get the client reconnected to those intensive case management services. But these intensive case management services are exactly what we need for folks. And I would encourage, you know, the committee and the council and HIV health services to kind of really look at the model that the Institute on Aging uses for case management, if there's any interest in further funding intensive case management in the city, because they do a fantastic job I just am never able to get anybody connected because there's always a duplication of services involved. So it would be lovely to have something like that within the HIV health services that we could dip into to get clients connected to. And I, with that, I don't think I had anything more specific to follow up on. I wanted to highlight those two because I think they highlight important needs, but I'm available for any other questions.
Hi, Stephen. Can you repeat again? You mentioned the aging, or what was the department that you were just referring to? I want to make sure.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So it's called the Institute on Aging, mm-hmm. and they developed a fund called the Community Living Fund. And the Community Living Fund provides intensive case management support to folks who are exiting out of skilled nursing facilities.
Okay.
And I'm happy to talk more with you about it. I'm happy to introduce you to the folks that I work with there. They're really, I have to say, amazing providers. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
It will be a good thing definitely for you to investigate more, Maria. CLF, there was a presentation on CLF right before the pandemic to the council. There's, even though it's not, you know, it's not a Ryan White funding stream, there's just like a lot of intersections between the different communities that that funding and actually that agency and that entire department has with our folks. Shanti, for example, I mean, as an agency that serves multiple people, has like CLF funding and Ryan White like this, and often within like a say like a community that are that looks quite similar to each other, despite the different funding streams.
Do you think it's worth investigating whether or not maybe we could have someone from that department in IOC to come in and talk to this subcommittee about their services?
Maybe even better to have a have them back to the full council, or some entity that could speak on sort of the range of connected services. We do have on the work plan something I think around that could fit this. So let me look into that, Derek. But yeah, I'd hate to actually just relegate it to one committee. We're supposed to be understanding and knowing about how different funding streams, different departments all intersect with each other in an attempt to like do some version of de-siloing. So yeah, let me look into that.
It would be good to know where the deficits in funding are in terms of population need, you know, people that are falling through the cracks like this that have extra special need. So someone that could speak to something like that.
Yeah. And plus we also, I mean, we know the challenge on our side, right? Even though we receive a very healthy amount of money for, through Ryan White, we're at that point now where it's kind of, we want to keep things as they are, while also we notice that there are different needs that only more money could solve, but to not just express those needs, but to reach those needs, that would mean that we'd have to look at the system of care that we feel has already been like reduced considerably, and like, is that a place that's still efficacious? Like, okay, then where would we pull that money? That's the big challenge we have when we have these kinds of gaps brought to us, which is like, okay, absolutely, that's a gap, but like, what service category is being underutilized, or, you know, and that's like this many, you know.
I do think that the budget asks that came from Happen and Han do include an ask for intensive case management. So it might be relevant to the committee and to the council when prioritizing and allocating funding this year.
Absolutely. Of course, for us, that would only be advisory. We don't, I mean, HHS has always been kind to us as far as seeing us as partners and often putting the general fund or even specially funded services up there for us to advise on. But yeah, I do think that the main path to getting more funds is actually through Happen. And I don't know if the other HSN is still doing advocacy as well, is through those efforts. But yeah, when it comes to us, I don't see either us or HHS trying to stop that from serving our clients.
Yeah, no, I don't think so.
Well, it's also, I think, worthwhile having a discussion around, and Stefan was just speaking about this in terms of, you know, where we see duplication of services, barriers, how we can either navigate through that or past that, or, you know, what sort of arrangements we can make happen to allow for services to be had when we're at an impasse in a particular channel is worth having as well. So we have 4 minutes still in this section. If there's any other questions or comments that people may have. Stephen, as always, thank you so much for your great work and yeah.
Thank you all.
So I think we are at, why did that happen? I don't know why that happened.
We're at Kira now.
We're at Kira. We're at Cola's and needs assessment update. Thank you. Kira, take it away. Thank you so much. And thanks.
All right. So I'll go ahead and share my screen. I have a few documents to share. Okay, I'll start with this one. So we were actually able to wrap up our needs assessment from 2022. So that's some good news. And so this is just sort of a condensed report back of what we discussed and kind of what happened during this, during all of, or what happened from all of these surveys and these interviews that we conducted. So I'll go ahead and jump in. So first we have just like the discussion summary. So kind of the service categories that were talked about. And so I'll go ahead and get started with primary medical care. So this was one of the most talked about topics with a specific call out for a more cohesive and integrated system of care. So clients were having, described having to travel to various places, different locations to see different providers to receive an individual service rather than having an umbrella of care that kind of linked all of those services together in one location. Participants also described having a fear of not receiving the best care due to the lack of knowledge and empathetic doctors, getting too many referrals and prescribed medications, wait lists for surgeries that were too long, and also a lack of knowledge regarding post-surgery care for themselves. And so some of the quotes that we were able to extract from that were having to explain general trans issues to my doctor ain't it, do your own research, I'm not your teacher. Feels like I'm drowning in referrals from my doctor. Wait lists for surgery far too long. Meanwhile, I have to worry about the violence. Clinics are spread all over. Where is the umbrella for multiple services? And then someone actually mentioned Kaiser, we build a woman. And they actually described how this one participant described how they were able to get really great care when they went into Kaiser because they were able to get all of their services done in one location without having to travel to various different locations. Of course, housing was also a topic of concern. So participants detailed facing discrimination from neighbors and feeling a housing assignment was unsafe. Others also had concerns about moving and having their bills get lost in the mail. Mental health services was another topic of concern, with participants sharing that finding a therapist that is empathetic is hard. And in addition to that, the feelings of having to find a quality therapist while dealing with their own trauma is discouraging in itself. And some quotes from that were need to be defensive around, or the feeling of needing to be defensive around how folks perceive me. Don't just tolerate us, treat us. Feels like these places aren't taught how to treat trans folks with respect. Being judged in a space that's supposed to be safe. And then we had a facilitated conversation. And so this discussion portion was led by the question, how do you see yourself within the trans community? And so participants spoke of themselves as advocates, not only for themselves, but for those who come after them. They want to break down barriers they currently face as part of both the HIV plus community and the trans community. And they did share the fear of becoming invisible or being othered, even within their own community. And they attempted to share these experiences of identifying as trans and also the obstacles they face, separate from being HIV positive and the issues that come along with that. So some discussion points that stood out were participants described a lack of diversity within their own community and or a lack of diversity within their community and reflected back through them through the service providers. So really seeing diversity within their community and then that not being reflected back to them when they go to a service provider. The struggle to maintain economic stability. So having to manage benefits in order to qualify for them. The fear of disclosure of identity when not wanting that. So someone described having the meds that they took exposed that they're transgender. Some participants did praise Ward 86 for their continued support throughout their whole surgery process, starting from the navigational support to the emotional support. And then some other participants described how Teladoc allowed them flexibility for their appointments and scheduling without having to worry about the hassle of traveling or being on time to those appointments. And so some quotes from this discussion include freedom to pick and choose your own journey, the fight to live my life in togetherness, when finally finding out about how life should feel. It's a double-edged sword, brings on more discrimination and having HIV used as a weapon against me. Where's the respect for trans folk? Am I doing something wrong by being trans? Someone described making too much money and then at the same time, not enough. I quit two jobs in order to qualify for surgery. As soon as the nurse saw my chart, her attitude changed. I felt like I was back in school, the nurse huddles and side eyes. It's different when I dress neutral versus all done up. Struggling to find where I fit in exactly. And the last quote we included was, I feel like I'm always on the cusp within the community and not fitting in. And then I'll move on to some of our demographic data. All right. And so just for some background, this new assessment was a part of the continuation of our outreach efforts that began in 2022, and they've concluded now in 2023. And the community, this committee chose to focus on the trans community in 2022. So our outreach efforts were led by Dave Jordan and me in support with David Crown. And the participants were given a survey to fill out that consisted of 38 questions. And they were also interviewed in a discussion portion. And so both of these survey elements helped to give us a true idea of how participants interact with the system of care, as well as bring up any unmet needs that exist. And I do want to mention that due to the amount of time, the limit of time really, and the number of participants that we had in our last focus group, we weren't able to complete the prioritization exercise, but we were able to get a really good discussion going. So from August 2022 to February 2023 was when these surveys all took place. And in total, there were 25 participants that were surveyed. And the locations of these participants that were surveyed include the Shanti Project, where we had where we welcomed folks from different drop-in groups. And then the most recent one, which was TransLife SF. And the participation, of course, was incentivized by a $25 Safeway gift card. And so this is just kind of an overview of what our presentation, a really rough draft of what it may look like. So covering just demographic data, including our findings and any conclusions and recommendations that come out of everything. And so the first demographic data was, we asked the question, what is your age? And so all of our participants were over 25. And then what is your gender identity? So a majority of our participants identified as transgender female, and we actually had a good number identify as gender non-conforming. So you can kind of see that in the chart. And then how long have you been living with HIV? 40% of our participants have been living with HIV for more than 20 years. And then 12% of participants, which is it's three participants, have been living with HIV for 1 to 5 years. And similarly, three participants have been living with HIV for 5 to 10 years. So that was more on the low end. And are you engaged in medical care? So almost all of the participants reported that they were engaged in medical care. So that's really good to know. And I'll go ahead and stop sharing my screen. Did you want to add anything, Crown or Mark?
Not in particular, just to highlight that, like, I wish we did have a little bit more time. The time limit was kind of a little bit of a bummer, but it was extremely robust, our last focus group, just having, you know, 20 folks in a really, really robust conversation around these needs was just really exciting for me for my first time.
I saw on the age slide, I should have mentioned this when we met earlier, Kira, that the option that everyone chose was 25 and older. So am I to take it then that there weren't any options to like sort of break down the age ranges beyond 25 and above?
Correct. There weren't any other options.
Okay. So for future ones, we'll just make sure to have maybe more brackets there so we can get sort of to, you know, an understanding of how many like seniors or something like that. Or other age ranges, but okay. It's a small enough sample size where I don't think that hurts it. And I'm sad to say I was actually responding to an email at the end of your first presentation. And I don't know, did you go over the recommendations? I think I might.
Oh, ooh, actually, I missed that part completely. Let me pull it up again. There we go. They were lost on the third page. And these were, okay, so out of everything in our conclusions, these are just some ideas of recommendations. So that includes training and education of trans needs and issues with service providers. So just better training to provide a greater level of respect and to better anticipate needs rather than just responding to needs. So that would include training on inclusivity that service providers could also ensure that there's a safe space created for trans folks of color, as well as referral systems that are more user-friendly and easily understood. So a lot of participants described being really overwhelmed with the number of referrals that they received. Also emotional and navigational support for those who want to receive surgery. I think this was a really big topic because a lot of people described either having these huge wait lists for surgeries, and then also once it was kind of their turn, they were really overwhelmed and confused by what exactly that process entailed. So this would include help with the process of qualifying for surgery and getting the document signed off for approval to all the way to post-surgery emotional support. So that, for example, could be checking up on a client in the hospital. Go ahead, Mark.
So thank you for going over that. I'm wondering what folks feel. I mean, there's two things that really stick out to me here that I'm curious what the group feels. One seems like it's not a fix because, you know, these are ongoing challenges in some ways, but in some ways like an easy way to respond. What sticks out to me is that first one, right? You know, we certainly have heard from John Ainsley multiple times about, and before John, Kevin Hutchcroft, about all the different trainings that have been provided to different providers. And so certainly a recommendation around a trans-specific training, whether that's cultural competency-based or cultural humility-based, however that might be, I think, a really solid recommendation that HHS could pretty easily pick up. They have set aside funds for that. So I think that's one thing that we can, you know, work on that language with if the committee agrees that this seems like a pretty solid recommendation based on a lot of the commentary in this needs assessment. Would folks agree with that before I move on to the second one?
Yeah, no, I think that's an excellent idea. And making sure that these comments are noted. So, you know, in substitute of someone actually being there and talking about it, you have those comments handy.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so with Maria here, of course, that means we actually have a pipeline to HHS with these with that particular recommendation. The second recommendation, I think, is going to be more pie in the sky, because like I just outlined before, like we only have so much funds and the funds right now are really dedicated to valuable resources. But we might want to have a recommendation just based on what we saw here to consider more trans-specific, like COE level wraparound type services, you know, that whole idea of like easy access kind of goes out the window if one of the key services is maybe, you know, gender transition and all that entails. Again, like, I'm not saying we have the money to fund that, but that doesn't mean that that's not a conclusion and a recommendation that couldn't be made. Does that make sense as far as, like, we can't ignore it, even though we can't necessarily do anything about it unless we get a windfall from the feds? Unlikely. But we could at least, like, that's, I think, a pretty clear conclusion that could be drawn from what I just saw. Would you all agree with that?
I do. And one of the things that I keep coming back to is it would be great to be able to keep track of, you know, there's so much need out there, but maybe just keeping track of some of these things that we make note of or feel strongly about, but are unable to kind of change our prioritization and allocation around, just for in the future that we have a list handy.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Mark, I was just going to say, I think there's some EAG services too that were allotted towards, I don't know if you guys have ever been in touch with Jenna Rapque.
Oh, yes.
And so there's that funding that went to Gender Health, I believe the name of the program is, but
yeah, we received a presentation from them. Yeah, last year, I think. You know, that's in some ways like a good place for us to look at referrals, right? Because that is a robust program. I think a part of it's like what we also saw in there is communication. You know, unless there's actually word of mouth about like where to go, some folks just actually might do the default of like, well, I know what I know. This is where I'm going, you know. Any other thoughts about how our conclusion / recommendation should look when Kira presents this again next month to the full council? Or do those sound good with my additions?
I have a question, actually, and it is, it was in reference to the medical piece. I think you were talking about almost everyone was in medical care. And my first thought was I wasn't clear whether or not that was in reference to just HIV. Was it in reference to just transgender services, or was it the combination of both HIV and transgender medical care and services? Was there any idea around that sort of breakdown?
So there actually was no other breakdown in terms of that specific question. So it's, that's actually a really good thing to note for our future needs assessment, because I think that is really important. But no, to answer your question, no.
I think it also is in some ways something we can figure out ourselves. It's not spelled out, but if these are our Ryan White clients, then their primary care is going to be geared around HIV, right? That's what's actually the funding stream to provide that. And so in some ways it is like luck of the draw if they happen to get a medical provider who is also familiar with the level of medical care that they might specifically need. There are a lot of physicians and nurse practitioners in San Francisco who have that level of expertise, right? But also that's not going to be necessarily where a client will be directed automatically. You know, they're going to be directed automatically to the primary care site that has funding that can support their needs. And so I think that's what we saw in some of the comments, right? As far as like having to explain their own gender identity, their own like biological sex needs based around transition to someone who might actually have, if they have a level of expertise, it might only be around like, say, HIV, or it might be around this or that. Does that make sense, Derek? As far as like, it makes like, as far as like how we're even getting these folks in our needs assessment, they're Ryan White Part A clients.
So it does, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're processing it.
Sorry,
so for instance, I'm sorry.
Can you repeat that? You froze. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. It does make sense, but I don't know. There isn't an idea that this is the way that these folks are translating that as something that they're doing. So they might be connecting to the survey through just by word of mouth, or like maybe through another service provider, but it's not, they may not be connected to HIV care. They may be connected to auxiliary services, HIV services, but as far as medical care, they're more concerned or focused on their transgender and identified supports and services that are medicalized, as opposed to, you know what I mean? Like, and some folks, it may be true that, you know, they're not getting the sort of transgender supports that they would like to have, but they actually have HIV services. So I don't want to make that assumption that folks are getting both, or are, you know what I mean? Or just having,
yeah.
If you're talking about medical services, you're talking about HIV only.
That makes sense. I think what stood out to me though is that this the large survey group of 21 folks was Trans Thrive. Correct me if I'm wrong there, Kira. And yeah. Trans Thrive, you know, is a program of an HIV serving agency. And so even though we did see someone mention about like they go to Kaiser for something,
right.
So it's, like that's the point there. But I guess what I meant by like we can kind of figure it out was like, okay, if it came from Trans Thrive, then they are connected to the HIV system of care because Trans Thrive. But you're right, that doesn't mean automatically they're actually like, they could, you could be a trans person and have like say I'm only accessing Ryan White services through my transitional housing or through my emergency financial assistance, but I'm actually getting my medical care over here. So definitely your point is well taken. Looked like Derek, mm-hmm. Not Derek, Stephen had his hand up.
Thank you. Yeah, I was just going to thank you all for this. A lot of those comments are really powerful for me. They echo a lot of the things that I hear on a regular basis. And, you know, two that stood out that I think are resonating for one reason is at least because I heard something on the news this morning that was reminiscent. But, you know, this person that said, oh, I either make too much money or too little money. I had to give up two jobs just so that I could, you know, and that's true in the mental health world as well. I was listening to an article on NPR this morning where they said, you know, if you have Medi-Cal, I can give you the gold standard of care. But if you have income and you're not qualifying for Medi-Cal, I'm denying those services for certain high level psychological illness. I'm sorry. Excuse me one second. Pardon me. And the other thing is a trans care navigator. And this is something that I feel was echoed recently in a discussion that I went to at a conference where it was a lot of nonprofit folks doing a work group trying to figure out and have a discussion around how to connect with priority populations. And, you know, there was a group of maybe 60 of us providers, nonprofit providers, most of whom were in the legal sphere. And one person stood up and said, can I just ask a pointed question? How many people in here are trans? And like two people rose their hand. And she said, well, that's why, just so you know, that's why you can't connect with the community. So having folks at agencies that look like, you know, the folks that we're trying to connect with is a really critical component of connecting with them. I think that's why I shared, you know, having a trans care navigator would be great if it was somebody that had been with the lived experience that could walk them through and say, you know, even if, hey, listen, this is my experience. You're not going to have the same one, but this is what I can say, you know, that goes a long way for folks who are really struggling with figuring out the system. It is a difficult process. I mean, you get set for surgeries, but some surgeries you need to have multiple therapists to sign off on, and then those appointments, and then that has to happen in a certain order. And then of course, if one of them is a month too old, you have to do another appointment. By then that one's done. The other one is out of date. You know, I mean, it can be a real challenge for folks to just to manage the paperwork and the appointments that are necessary and the timeframes that they're given. And so it's a common problem that comes through my office.
You know, absolutely. But I was reminded once again of this discussion that I was having with a group of guys where someone was transitioning onto a different sort of insurance plan, and they were kind of confused about, you know, all the different categories of, do I take this? And if I get this, do I do this other thing? And there were members of the community that this person was from who had already gone through the process, and they were able to kind of go like, oh, you should consider this if this is the sort of thing you would be interested in. Have you talked to these set of folks about this? Like, this is really, and the guy was so relieved because he had so much anxiety about how do I go about and figure all this out. And suddenly he had, you know, four or five people that were able to give him very clear guidance from a very practical aspect that he had no idea was available to him. And it was really wonderful to see the relief on his face as he was talking to folks about the challenges as well as potential solutions to those challenges. Right there with you, Stephen.
I wonder if like a mentorship program is in order, or if there's space for that, or if one exists that I don't know about.
So are there, to go back with what Mark had been referencing in terms of the recommendations and for the presentation that Kira or Crown may be giving to full council in regards to their report, are there any other suggestions or marks that folks would like to offer? Kira, does this feel helpful at all?
Yeah, actually, Mark, can you repeat just so you can go over it one more time, the recommendations that you offered him?
Sure. So the first recommendation was actually your recommendation already. It was that first one around training. I mean, you and I can work on like maybe making that language a little bit more pointed as far as not calling out anyone, but like pointed as far as like, you know, we would like to strongly recommend a trans-specific training for service providers under the Ryan White system of care, et cetera. So you and I can work on that, but it's basically what you've already put down in your first recommendation. The only additional one would be consider supporting and advocating for what is the best term? I often will just say one-stop shop, but I feel like one-stop shopping is an outdated term these days. What is the term that should be used for a place where you can go that's like a center of excellence? Oh, there you go. A center of excellence based service provision. And so you and I can talk about that, but that would be the one addition. That's the pie in the sky one. That's only if for some reason like there's like advocacy equals actually enough money to create that, which that's a lot of advocacy, but doesn't mean we should shy away from naming that need based on what we've actually seen, right? And I think Stephen and Derek added sort of an idea around, no, actually it's already, you already have a recommendation around, I don't have it memorized, but the idea of being able to see like community members in provider roles is going to help not just like lessen like the sort of the automatic stigmatization that people often feel, but it'll actually increase comfort level and being able to talk to someone about all the different processes that a person has to go through. And not just around transition, but all just about accessing care. I think the only addition will be the sort of a COE based service provision. And then, you know, you're not going to work on that. We have a month and a half.
Awesome. Thank you. I feel like there was talk about a transgender services COE initially when the COEs were created, but I don't recall, you know, why they weren't able to move forward with it. But I can ask and see if there's.
Oh, I can tell you why I was there. I am that old that I was a part of the original Center of Excellence working group to help create the Centers of Excellence. It was because when we were trying to look at all the different populations, I think people felt that the Ward 86 Center of Excellence would be able to cover some of our most vulnerable populations. And so that's wide, right? That includes from trans to marginally housed to quote unquote severe need. But I think it was because like, okay, so we need to have one that's very specific towards Mission/Latino populations, very specific around this and this and this. And then it's kind of like, and then everyone else. It wasn't the best kind of decision-making, I think, in the long run, but we were also looking at numbers. You know, we were looking at like, well, how many, what number of the population actually is within this particular identity? Like, what are the different identity markers? So that, of course, meant that we had to have a mission-based / Latino COE. We had to have one that served women. We had to have one, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think if I was to go back in time and do it all over again, I mean, I would have just advocated for a lot more money gotten a couple more. I would have gotten a long-term survivor COE up in there too, as well as a trans COE for sure. But you know, hindsight, mm-hmm. not my friend.
Thank you guys. So we're at 4:12.
Oh, you muted yourself.
Oh. Ah. A lot of people prefer it that way, and
no one does.
We're at 4:12. We still have a few more moments. If there's anyone else who have some things on this topic, on this item,
you know, I might as well. I mentioned this will be a surprise for Kira because I mentioned we don't even need to mention this till next month. But hey, as long as we have time. Boom, I'll mention it, which is that membership is looking at different outreach to different kinds of populations. And so what we're planning on doing is for the major population, I feel like that we're under, which is the Latino population, we're connecting that with the needs assessment that y'all have recommended and that we'll be voting on at this month's meeting. And so there are other targets as well, not with the same level of urgency as that particular community, but they're definitely targets, youth, Black/African-American, and just unaffiliated. And so what we'd like to do is kind of a similar thing, which is like there's been one COLA target picked that we'll be working with Stephen Spano pretty closely with, because we don't know how else to find those particular participants. But that doesn't mean we can stop. We need to stop there. So what we're going to propose next month, after we get membership committee buy-in, so this is a real spoilers territory, is to like add on at least two more COLAs for just basically targeting the people that we also would love to bring onto the council. So we're going to have a recommendation to have a youth COLA and a Black/African-American COLA as well. Just wanted to give you a heads up.
Thank you. If I could, I just want to add one other thing, and that is I really like the idea that in the demographics that there were some non-gender conforming folks that were identifying themselves within the trans community umbrella as well. It's a little bit of a concern only because I am not 100% certain how comfortable folks may have felt with the idea of folks that were considering themselves non-gender conforming, just being under the transgender umbrella identity. So it was really nice to see that present there. And I know that there is a little bit not effort, but this sort of understanding of being inclusive of the trans community, including that identity as well. It was good to see that there.
If I could speak on that, that was interesting, right? I mean, I think that could have been potentially problematic if it wasn't within a support group that was literally called Trans Thrive. And so even though their identity might be gender nonconforming rather than trans, it was still under the auspices of a particular trans-centered intervention. Because, I mean, to be honest, like all of us here could be considered potentially gender nonconforming if we so desired to identify that way, right? Because what does gender nonconforming mean, essentially? And so it would be hard to put that within the sort of like specific parameters of a trans-focused needs assessment, unless those folks who identified as such were going to a trans intervention, which they were. Does that make sense? I just threw some gender ideology at y'all.
It does make a lot of sense to me, at least. Would you like to do that now, Stephen?
I think no, not right now, because we're gearing up for this other needs assessment. So I want the team to be focused more on the current Latino needs assessment, and sort of when that'll be ongoing. That's not going to be like one done in a month. I mean, literally, they will have the rest of the year to do it. But let's get started with that before we start bringing in the other COLAs. So then maybe like, you know, Kira and Crown can reach out to you at some point, Stephen, to set up a meeting for like that first COLA, maybe like in a couple months, if that's not too long a wait. What do you think?
No, that's fine. I'm trying to think about some of the complications I might encounter with regard to confidentiality, as far as referring folks, you know what we can do? We can kind of have a preliminary meeting. It might be as simple as me, you know, providing a referral to you all. I worry that a lot of folks who are experiencing housing insecurity are going to be less apt to prioritize that. But if it can be discussed as a way to communicate their needs and perhaps a source for additional referrals or services, then that might be an easier way to kind of do it. I just don't know the parameters. So, but you know, we can talk about it in a couple of months. That's fine. I worry that we'll get such a small sample group if we put it off too long.
We can do it sooner than 2 months for sure. And this is something that you could also, you know, be a part of if it creates more of a safe space. Like you could certainly be there as well. As we could be underlining, this is all anonymous. You know, we're mainly just going to get qualitative stuff from folks. I mean, we might do the survey, but if it's so focused on housing, I'm not sure we even need to do the prioritization exercise if this is really so much based around one particular service category, right? So it might just be a conversation where if they feel safe with you and you're there, then you could be a part of that with Kira and Crown as well.
I'm sorry, which target group is this again? Or is it still unnamed?
It is. Can someone tell me the specific name of it? Sorry.
If I remember, it was folks who have experienced multiple evictions or something of that nature. Yeah.
Yes, people who have experienced eviction.
Yeah.
Or eviction. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, so maybe then sometime in April rather than 2 months, we'll connect with you, Stephen, to make this happen.
I know this is a late announcement, but I think tomorrow there is a harm reduction group for transgender and non-conforming people over in the Castro tomorrow at 6 o'clock, which is sort of apropos to what we're talking about a bit. Is at the 4-7 Castro. And I can send you a flyer if you guys would like to have more information about it. I can send it either to Crown or Kira.
If you would like that sent to the council before it happens, I would definitely send that to Crown today, so that Crown can spread that word.
Thank you so much, Mark, for that. And Crown. So we're at 4:20, and we're at our last piece then, which is, I'm sorry, what?
No, I just like, I know what time it is for sure. Let's get out of this meeting.
Right. We're so our next meeting is coming up and is scheduled for April the 5th. Thank you so much, everyone, for allowing me to do this. Thank you, Richard. I will see you all later, guys. Okay, hope to talk to you soon, Maria.
Great job, Derek.
Thank you, man.
Later. Bye, everyone. Nice to meet you, Maria.
Thank you. Bye. Be in touch.